Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. A quick note to the SA Podcasters Guild. Thank you for the History Podcast of the Year Silver Award. I shared the honor with the 30 Years of Democracy podcast, part of the Times Live stable. It's pretty heartwarming to receive some sort of recognition. And thanks mainly to you, the listener. With that, it's back to episode 195, and we're swinging back to the east, to Zululand, where Chief Mpani Kazenzangakhona of the AmaZulu has not been idle for the last 2 or 3 years. When we last heard about Mpandi, after a few years of relative quiet, he took over from Dingaan as King of the AmaZulu, as you know, then began to plot against the AmaSwazi in the late 1840s. As he planned and plotted in the British outpost called Natal, this territory that abounded Durban, two men had arrived who were to alter South African history, Theophilus Shepston and Hans Schroeder. More about them in a moment. Mpandi thought of Eswatini, Swaziland, as a source of treasure, of booty, and a future place of refuge for his people just in case the Boers or the British should advance further into Zululand. The good relations between the Boers and the Swazi, at least running up to the mid-19th century, meant that Mpandi was forced to hold off most of his plans to invade King Mswati's land. It was also along a corridor coveted by not only the AmaZulu and the Swazi, but also by the Boers. So his first aim was northwest, towards smaller kingdoms, where the booty was thinner on the ground, not exactly a plethora of cows, rather a smattering but better than nix. The Amatlubi bore the brunt of Mpandi's expansionist aims when he attacked Langabalele Kaimtunkulu, who had told his people that from now on it was he and not Mpandi who would control the function of rainmaking. Mpandi disagreed. There were disputes going on inside Swazi territory, which gave the AmaZulu king an opportunity to interfere. If you remember in previous podcasts, I'd explained that after Mswati was declared the new young king of the AmaSwazi, the senior regent Malambuli tried to cling onto power and was backed in his clinging by Mpandi. Mpandi also sought to brush aside the Amatlubi further to the west, but up popped the Boers under Hendrik Potgieter, based in the Ooregstad Republic, northwest of Swaziland, and they were doing deals with various black chiefs in that area. This complicated things for Mpandi. Simultaneously, Mpandi was being scrutinized with an intense scrut by the British based in Port Natal. When Malambuli made the fatal mistake of running southwards into the arms of the protective Boers, Mpandi informed the British that he had to act in self-defense because the Swazi kingdom appeared to be in shambles. Early in 1847, the Zulu army had marched north over the Pongola River in several sections and made it as far north as the Crocodile River. That's when the Swazi's secret weapon, their mountains, came into play, and Mswati retreated into the caves with his people and livestock. The Zulu Amabutu were left without food and faced AmaSwazi guerrilla attacks, an amazing use of unconventional methods in this war between the Zulu and the Swazi. The AmaZulu were more used to conventional fighting, and the shift to hit and run caused morale issues, not to mention a few losses during skirmishes. The Swazi also used nearby Boers as cover. That was an even more unconventional response. The Amabutu didn't want to start another war with the Trekkers and were baffled by the hit-and-run Swazi tactics, as historian John Labunt notes in his great book, Rope of Sand. The AmaZulu Amabutu left Swazi territory, but Mpandi sent them back further west. This time they attacked Langalbalele's Amatlubi again, then raided Chief Putini of the Ngwe people. They lived further west indeed, in the foothills of the Drakensberg, between the Bushman's River and Little Tugela. If you glance at a map, about where Dundee is today. In August 1848, Langalibalele gathered his people and crossed the Mzinyati into Natal. A few weeks later, they were followed by thousands of the Amaingwe people. This began to unnerve the British and the colonists, who were rather thin on the ground. Back home at his great place, Izibongo praise poems were being sung about Mpandi. Inhle hlanyo mbani ka Ndaba, the backslider of Ndaba. Inhlehle le futi ingo Bulawayo, backsliding through Bulawayo. Inhlehle izinkomo zama Swazi, retreating from Swazi cattle. Perhaps stung by some of these badly sung proses, Mpandi gathered his army to turn northeast back towards Swaziland, bolstered by the knowledge that Mswati was fighting his other brother, Sobhuza, who had also tired of the young king having power over him, an older sibling. During the invasion, Mpandi's eldest son, Cetshwayo, proved his capacities as a leader, and it's a name we must remember. Cetshwayo would go on to become one of the most feared leaders of the AmaZulu, as the British learned to their cost at Isandlwana. The invasion may have led to the Swati kingdom facing destruction. It was at this crucial juncture that the British pressurized Mpandi into withdrawing, which he did fairly rapidly. Mswati duly sued for peace, and after vacillating, Mpandi accepted, again under pressure from the British. So it ended up with Mswati paying a form of tribute to the Zulu, despite being undefeated. Diplomatic neutral gear. Into stage left, a missionary who was on a mission. Into stage right, a second missionary on another mission. Cast member number one, stage left, Theophilus Shepston, or Somtsu, as the Zulu called him. The other, stage right, was lesser known Norwegian Missionary Society's Hans Schroeder. The latter was well over 6 feet tall, powerful man with a powerful temper. He may have been a Bible-wielding man of God, but that didn't stop the Viking blood pumping him up when he was crossed. Schroeder would establish 7 mission stations across Zululand and was going to be extremely useful as Mpandi's diplomat. Shepston's role in our story is a complex combination of missionary, Zulufile, Anglophone civilizer-in-chief, a vast figure in our tale. He would go on to suffer many a baleful settler glare. The colonists believed his pro-Zulu politics were dangerous to the almost infinite demand for labour and land. As the Cape colonials moved towards self-government, Natal became a bit of a problem child. At this point, the early 1850s, Natal was the territory bounded by the Tugela River in the north, the Mzumkulu River in the south, and the Drakensberg Mountains in the west. Abutting Natal to the north were two Boer-controlled areas. The Klip River territory lay between the Tugela and the Imzinyati or Buffalo River. The second, the Utrecht Republic, stretched from the Imzinyati to the Nkomi or Blood River. Stretched is probably a stretch. The Utrecht Republic was tiny, a few hundred square kilometres, with no urban centre of any note within. Even the modern town of Vryheid was well to the east. But this territory was symbolic, bordered by the Blood River, where the Boers had won that major battle against the AmaZulu on the 16th of December, 1838. A scant 12 years later, and Mpandi, who had recognized these two bits of territory as Boer-owned, began to have second thoughts. This was going to become even more of a problem when a third territory was disputed. This little place was northeast of the Utrecht Republic, towards the modern area of Port Pietersburg. As Mpandi began to have his second thoughts, it was as though Mswati could read these. The Swazi king was receiving information, human intelligence sources, or in a word, spies. Later in 1852, Mswati fired up his army to break free from Zulu overlordship. Mpandi, if you recall, had been painted as a kind of weak king by historians because of his dealings with the Boers and the British. Revisionist historians think of him as a sellout because he didn't fight the Boers to the death. He'd done a deal with the Boers when the Zulu civil war broke out and killed Dingaan. Dingaan is the poster child for later struggle and Africanist ideologies, so Mpandi has always had a bit of a bad rap. Mpandi also knew full well how diplomacy worked and didn't stick a middle finger in the faces of the British either. He balanced the Boers against the British, dangling them in front of each other. He'd also built up a considerable catalogue of successes, both internal and external, which kind of blows up the nasty anti-Mpandi stuff. Because if you listen to the oral history and follow the events with a clear mind, Mpandi was still ruling a powerful kingdom in the early 1850s. Not only powerful, it was the most powerful political and military entity in the northeast of South Africa, including the Boer and British territories. There's no debate about this, but we tend to forget about that these days. By the early 1850s, he was unchallenged at home and militarily dominant over his marches. Filled with this confidence, he allowed Hans Schroeder of the Norwegian Missionary Society, stage right, to set up his sole conversion business in Zululand. Mpandi was a nuanced diplomat, understanding the difference between one white man and another. That Schroeder was not English, that he was Norwegian. The first thing that Schroeder did was to inveigle himself into Mpandi's inner circle by administering medicine to the king, who often suffered from maladies brought on by obesity. After being relieved of pain, possibly with a vial of opium, Mpandi allowed Schroeder to establish his first mission station at Kwa Nodwengu. That's near Mpangeni, near the mouth of the Umhlatuzi River. Schroeder was apparently welcomed by all the local zoo because of his skills in irrigation and ploughing, well digging, and reading and writing. However, his skill in proselytizing was somewhat less welcome. Schroeder would send out a young boy with a gong on a Sunday who walked around what is now the town of Empangeni, banging his gong, summoning converts. When the 160 or so arrived, mainly women, they gathered and sat on the grass near his hut, and then Schroeder would read to the people from his isiZulu Bible. Then they would all sing hymns that he translated into isiZulu. While all of this was going on, the Swazi King Mswati was banging on an alternative gong and trying to expand his area of influence southwesterly in 1852. Mpandi wrote letters to the British complaining that Mswati was destabilizing the region, then sent a large Amabutu to invade Swaziland. And this time, the sheer power of the AmaZulu army took Mswati by surprise. With thousands of head of cattle being driven south, vast herds were lost to the Swazi in that operation. Mswati formally appealed for help from the British again, saying the people of Natal should accept thousands more refugees. And of course, the British were horrified. Here were possibly a flood of hungry people heading straight for Natal, where only a few thousand white settlers lived. They were going to be swamped, thought the British. It so happens that Mpandi was simultaneously coming under pressure from his own councillors, who frowned on this madcap venture of trying to destroy the Swazi, come what may. The recurring Swazi nightmare kind of thing. The area between the Tugela River and the Pongola had been riven by internecine violence for generations. Jobe of the Amandwandwe, then Shaka of the AmaZulu, who was actually assassinated while his army was in the field in Swaziland, then Dingaan, now Mpandi, all had continued the tradition of Amabutering all over the north, weakening the army without a clear political aim. So Mpandi ordered his army back, and Mswati survived. No, thrived, because now he was protected by the British, and in the west by the Boers to a less extent. So once things settled down, Mswati immediately began a little raiding of his own along the headwaters of the Pongola River. A king's got to do what a king's got to do. Mpandi was under the cosh. He'd been fighting many wars. Let me list what he'd been up to, apart from trying to defeat the Swazi. The Zulu king had attacked Chief Sekwati of the Bapedi, who lived in the mountainous country of the northeastern Transvaal, Mpumalanga. After that successful impi raid, Mpandi's praise poet sang, Wamudli umchikia kubisutu pakwa pahla pahla. You devoured umchikila among the pahla pahla sutu. O tukutele, wawel, o balule, engemvula, yezinyembezi. In wrath, you crossed Baluli with a rain of tears. Wa inkabeni ka Sekwata kubisutu. You went to Sekwata Seraglio among the Sutus. Mpandi had also sent sections of his army to the northeastern plateau where the Tsonga people had been paying tribute. A dynastic dispute reared its ugly head in the Mabudu chiefdom, and Mpandi intervened, ensuring that his ally Noziyingili took charge. Next to feel the sting of AmaZulu power were the Pedi, who were adept, like the Swazi, at keeping out of the way by retreating into their scenic mountains. Still, the Amabutu seized the respectable haul of booty on the hoof. And yet, the inability to defeat Mswati rankled the AmaZulu king. This festering frustration would lead to another attempt to raid Swaziland, but that was 6 years away in 1858. With that information, let's plunge back into the pool of fantastic facts of the early 1850s. If federation was the goal, then New Zealand won the trophy. It was the first British colony to be granted federation status. Yes, folks, all whites in all black territory won the very first federation from the British Empire award. Our departed friend, depending on your political persuasion, Earl Grey, Secretary of the Colonies, had proposed a federal solution to the Australian sovereignty and coastal colonies. The Voortrekker Republics had actually been a form of federalism. The Suid-Afrikaan newspaper in all its editorial glory of the time had been deifying federalism. In South Africa, if federation was the goal, then there was a concomitant link, what technocrats back in the day referred to as native policy. These days, there's native advertising. It's about publications allowing advertisers to use the same look and feel, font and design in an ad to make it look like it's a real news story. But native policy in 1852 was a different kettle of fish, because each little part of early South Africa had a different native policy. Divergent policy, to deploy the official phrase of the time. Within the Cape, the rule was a kind of French thing Fusionnement. This is civil and political equality between black, white and coloured, or more accurately, white, coloured and black, in that order. In Natal, well, Natal, or today KwaZulu-Natal, it was its own child in time. The settlers in Natal found themselves faced by thousands of refugees, an influx that grew steadily as the Boer republics expanded, as Mpandi's difficulties mounted, as the Swazi's internal conflict swirled. Theophilus Shepston, Somsu, wrote copious letters on the subject, and in some he would mention that dozens, perhaps hundreds of people were crossing the Tugela south every day, escaping an unstable Zululand. These were survivors of those various wars I've been describing, including Boer and Zulu, Zulu and Swazi, Zulu and Bapedi, etc., etc. The refugees' main strategy was to head south to Natal, hunker down, then return to their homes as soon as things quietened down. Major Thomas Charlton Smith, who had led the British invasion into Natal, suggested reserves for black people should be set up under magisterial and missionary control. Ah, reserves. The first inkling of what solutions could be found to labour limitations, control over movement, and defined areas in which black people would inhabit. Yes, dear listener, this was the first phase of what we came to know as Bantustans. This nomenclature, by the way, has always been a bit confused. I mean, why Bantustan? Stan is a Persian word. In geographical and linguistic terms, the suffix stan is derived from Persian and means land or place of. That is why many Central Asian countries have names ending in stan, like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and of course, Afghanistan. These names generally translate to land of the Kazakhs, land of the Uzbeks, land of the Afghans, identifying both a region and ethnic or cultural group. The root of this word comes from Sanskrit, where stana has a similar meaning of place or ground. So it's amazing that some bloke sitting in apartheid South Africa used a chunk of Sanskrit to name homelands, Bantustans, the place of. The Transkei, place of Amaxhosa. Siskai, also place of Amaxhosa. Confused? Yes, but that's South African history for you. By the 1850s, Natal was in a curious state of transition. Although formally annexed by the crown for Queen Victoria, its status and form of government remained uncertain. This was to remain the most constant factor in Natal's history for generations thereafter. The Volksraad of the Voortrekkers Republic of Natalia continued to meet in Pietermaritzburg under the distant supervision of the British Commandant Major Smith. Smith controlled most of the port of Natal, or Durban, and its immediate surrounds, but he could not say with any emphatic tone of voice that he controlled Pietermaritzburg. The most powerful political force in the territory was actually Mpande of the AmaZulu. Each of these three polities, the Boers, the British, and the Zulu, had recently suffered defeats at the hands of the other. None exercised control over the whole region, although Mpande was the most powerful. That's incredible. Furthermore, there were large-scale and relatively unhindered movement of people around the Natal Zululand area. Black peasants and pastoralists and various clans and kinship groups sought to return to the ancestral land now claimed by the Boers. Hunters and traders and trekkers continued to move about without political hindrance across the southern African frontiers between the Cape and Natal, or between the Highveld and Natal, or the Highveld and the Lowveld, or from the Transorangia into the Transvaal, and so on. British Commissioner Henry Clutie suggested the idea of segregating local black people and made his feeling known when a land commission sat in early 1850. The sitters included Theophilus Shepston. He called for 8 reserves to be set aside of just over 1.1 million acres in total. The commission also proposed to station native agents in each reserve and then wanted model mechanical schools focusing on agriculture built, while black police under white officers would be hired to keep the order. The grand plan was shelved. There was no money to set up such a vast network of technocrats, but the land was earmarked. And after this, at least 80,000 people, Bantu speakers, not all Zulu, were herded into these reserves. Another 50,000, though, remained on Crown lands or on the white farms around Natal. A question of the law arose fairly rapidly, which were British subjects and thus exposed to Roman Dutch law and which were not. Clutie preferred everyone to fall under the Roman Dutch system, whereas Shepston preferred black South Africans to be distinguished by their race and therefore subjected to native law, as it was called. Eventually, the British called in a mediator to solve the Shepston-Clutie debate, and Cape Attorney General William Porter was shipped up from Cape Town. Porter was an oddity, Having been born in Derry, in Ireland, and was raised by a strong liberal family, he arrived in the Cape as Attorney General with what he called an unspeakable hatred of oppression of every kind, and set about promoting equal rights and justice for all, regardless of race or class. When the first Parliament was inaugurated in the Cape in a couple of years, 1854, it was Porter who was one of the primary drafters of that constitution. The small town of Porterville in the Western Cape is named after him. I'll come back to Porter in a couple of episodes when we deal with that first Parliament in more detail. Right now, he was mediating this Natal dispute, and despite his comments about promoting equal rights for all, regardless of race or class, he ruled in favour of Shepstone. From now on, racial differentiation distinguished Natal policy from that of the Cape. There would be one law for whites and one law for blacks in Natal. The local Bantu-speaking people of Natal were subject to traditional law, not Roman Dutch law, with the proviso that it was not repugnant to the dictates of humanity, as Porter wrote. No killing of witches, in other words. The traditional law would be administered by local chiefs, assisted by what were called native magistrates, with an appeal process that led to the great chief deciding. He was actually the British Natal Lieutenant Governor. What happened was the administration of this law turned into a kind of revolution in policy because it combined judicial and executive functions in the hands of a diplomatic agent. When the chief's decision was challenged, local black people in Natal sought the diplomatic agent's attention, and the diplomatic agent was Theophilus Shepstone, Som Tzu. The most vocal opponents of the system of native law and reserves weren't chiefs like Mpande. No, they were the colonists living in Natal. The great chief in 1853 was Lieutenant Governor Sir Benjamin Pine. He had quite a challenge on his hands. The reserves were unwieldy and vast, at least 40,000 acres each. Shepstone himself admitted the system was defective and wanted to scrap the idea eventually. And instead of reserves, he mooted moving the black refugees lock, stock and barrel to the relatively empty lands down in the southwestern reaches of Natal between the Umtambuna and Umkhamanzi rivers. Authorities hesitated, but the colonists began to lop off bits of the reserves, buying the borderlands between white farms and black reserve areas. The settlers complained that Shepstone's system was a dangerous idea, like the Cut River settlement in the Albany region. Blacks could hide in these reserves, said the colonists, draining off labour. Furthermore, they were a threat to safety and security because they were massing in the centre of the Natal colony. Another commission in late 1852 was appointed to probe and prod the issue. The commission was composed mainly of big landowners whose only interest in the future was access to more land and cheap labour. Shepstone was condemned, the departed Boer Republic was eulogised, and there was much finger-pointing and hand-waving. As with many commissions, however, once the fury had dissipated, all that happened was that the reserves were retained, just the names were changed. Native magistrates became assistant magistrates, and diplomatic agent became secretary for native affairs. Renaming had no effect on anything other than costing money changing letterheads. This, dear listener, is a very old South African trick. By the time we're done with this series, you'll hear literally thousands of examples. The disease of lexicon twisting continues. It is the opiate of the political cadre class. Change the name, cut the ribbon, shoot a few shaky video clips for the social media platform. After 1852, the grumpy colonial landowners of Natal subsided back into profiteering. Point made, they thought. Meanwhile, Shepstone took up a more radical idea. He wanted to create a republic for black people inside Natal. A stan. Chief Faku of the Mampondo across the Mzimvubu River listened intently as he heard reports about some of Shepstone's plans. Faku was being plagued by the sand raiders, I explained, had run rampant along the hills of the Drakensberg and was willing to cede that bit of his territory to the missionary for his new republic. That would get rid of one of his problems, and then it would be the British problem to cope with these highly effective sand raiders. Theophilus proposed that he lead 50,000 Natal Zulus to this new land, and he would rule there as a kind of benevolent white chief. Preparations were made for this great trek, but things would change. So when we come back next episode, I'll explain how the squatters' law developed and how the confusing laws and even more confusing borders were intertwined in a kind of illogical matrix, subject to specious and subjective decision-making. Vagrancy laws were loose on the edges, literally, where some black local chiefs were given special burgher rights in parts of the Transvaal. honorary whites, to use a slightly anachronistic phrase. But that, it's time to end this episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about a couple of episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, tot ziens.